stereotyped all the time.
Great, you passed.
that warm. It is a cold morning. You can just do them both and then we'll grade them both. Check, check. Does anybody know what's special about 2011 for readers of the English Bible? What's special about 2011 for... That's right. 400 years of the King James Version. 400 years of the King James Version. This Bible I have here has a great little dictionary in it about of some of the... What's that? No, it should work here in just a second. It takes a little bit of time to warm up, I think. How many of you guys grew up reading the King James?
I didn't even know what it was till like...
You did also? So how many of you guys... How many of you guys, raise your hand if you grew up reading, memorizing, using the King James Bible? Wow. I think that number is shrinking and shrinking quickly, so that's interesting. But there was a National Geographic article, the cover story actually of the National Geographic this month was the King James Bible, and it had in there a foldout of all the phrases that were for the first time seen in English in the King James Bible that had been picked up and repeated and become part of the English language. Like the phrase, from time to time, that was by far the most popular phrase out of the King James Bible that was picked up in other literature, you know, and is now just common use in English. By the skin of my teeth, that's from what book? Corinthians 13, you guys know what it says in the King James for instead of love, what word it uses?
Charity,
that's right. Nowadays we think of charity as more like acts of kindness for people that don't have anything, right? But, one other thing I'll tell you is that on the lessons, for today, lesson 12 on the Job page in Populate, I put this chart up here. I compiled. Whoops. That's not helpful, is it? Here's a little chart on some of the things. I kind of reworked the concept a little bit for myself. I put the pluses, the minuses, and then equals, you know, on there. So wait, I don't want to give away too much of the information ahead of time, but you can use that if you want to. You download it from the Populate site. And with that, we're ready for this. But let me read you a verse out of the King James just to get started today. See if you can understand it. One of the greatest chapters in the Bible have to be Romans chapter 8, so I'll read you the last couple verses of Romans 8. Romans 8, 37 to 39. Nay, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him that loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Beautiful, isn't it? You know, one of the things they did with the King James when they were doing the translation of it, they had each of the six sections of Scripture assigned to different scholars, and then they would come together, each one of the scholars would do their own translation, and they would have a previous Bible, like the Geneva Bible or other ones, but they wouldn't look at the written translation of the King James. They would hear it. So it would be read out loud, and that's kind of how they tested it, to make sure it sounded good, because most people weren't literate at the time still. And so most people were going to be hearing it read aloud, and that was how they tested it. So one of the things you get with King James is a very melodic, rhythmic type of reading, so it's great. But a lot of the words are very unfamiliar. If we have time at the end, I'll pull out the dictionary in the back here that points out all the words that nobody today understands. There's some hilarious words in there, so we'll see if we get a chance to come to that in a little bit. But for now, last week we had our big debate on Elihu, and how did it end up? Who came away on Elihu's side, that you would defend him as a guy who was pretty much right on? Anybody? All right, we have a few. Who came away feeling like Elihu was not your friend, not Job's friend, and not a good person? Anybody? So how many of you guys are kind of in the middle, like you don't know what to do with him still? All right, that's most. What's that, Steve? I didn't make it very... All right, so who gives him the thumbs up? Let's put it that way. Who gives him thumbs down? who's like this? Okay, still. Divided equally into all three categories, pretty much. All right, so today's class, we're going to go through Job 32 to 37 a little more closely. And we'll have questions and discussion, of course. And then at the end, we're going to do exam 3. Exam 3 is going to be open Bible. And you've already been through these chapters, so you are well prepared for most of the questions on there. All right. Let's see here. Did anyone read the Good Friday article? I think I mentioned it, some of you guys. Good little overview. It's not Good Friday during this semester, but it's a good thought about how, you know, the suffering of Jesus relates to human suffering. Some good quotes in there, too. All right, so we're going to discuss Elihu and hopefully come away with a little bit clearer picture of what he's in the book of Job for, why the Holy Spirit inspired the author of Job to put him in. And so let's go over a little bit of background. He's the younger man, and he's been waiting patiently. And we've talked about this. I think we actually mentioned this in the very beginning of the class, the triangle of claims in Job. Remember this from the introduction? All right. Do you think this holds true? That Job's emphasis, the thing he's most concerned with, is his own righteousness and saying that I don't deserve the suffering. say in chapter 32. Anybody want to read the intro? Chapter 32, verses 1 and 2, I think.
So these three men stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. But Elihu, son of Barakel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, became very angry with Job. Job was justifying himself rather than God.
Alright. So he's angry with Job because he's justifying himself rather than God. And why is he angry with his friends?
He was also angry with three friends because they had found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him.
Right. So they condemned Job as a sinner, but hadn't found any way to actually refute him. Right? So the argument had gone back and forth. And so he's trying to come and take God's side and not commit any of the errors of Job, justifying himself rather than God. So he's going to uphold God's justice, but he's going to make sure that he doesn't condemn Job without, you know, a proper argument to do so. Okay? So that's a little bit of the background on the triangle of claims in Job. That helps us understand it, Elihu's role a little bit better. But let's go over the principle of retribution again. Who has it memorized? You just have it down pat. What's the principle of retribution you find in the Bible?
You reap what you sow.
You reap what you sow is the way it's stated in Galatians 6:7. Here's it's a if-then formulation. If a person is righteous, then he or she will prosper. If a person is wicked, then he or she will suffer. That's the principle of retribution. Okay? What's the corollary to the principle of retribution? Yeah, Mike. Right, so it reverses. Here again, back to the principle of retribution. If a person is righteous, he will prosper. If a person is wicked, will suffer. The corollary flips it around and says, if a person prospers, then that must mean that he's righteous. If a person suffers, then he or she is wicked. Right? And the friends are basically exercising this corollary when they condemn Job. They're saying that we see suffering, therefore he must be wicked. So we'll see if Elihu does buy into that same idea. What's appeasement theology?
Appease God so you can be blessed.
Right, and what does it mean to appease God? Admit, yeah. So it would be, first of all, God is angry. These are some harsh special. You want to see that one again? God is angry. God is angry. Okay, so it assumes, first of all, that God is angry with you. That's, in other words, suffering indicates that God is angry. Do whatever it takes to appease his anger, which means to satisfy it, you know, appease his anger so that you can prosper again. Does that make sense? It assumes that because you see suffering, that must mean God is angry. So therefore, do whatever it takes to appease that anger so you can prosper again, even if it means confessing your guilt even when there isn't any. All right, appeasement theology assumes that the corollary to the principle of retribution is true, right? Because we know God is angry with the wicked, with wickedness, and it assumes that if you see suffering, then it means that the person is wicked. And that's why God is angry. It involves a blanket confession, usually, of guilt. So Job would have to give up his insistence on being innocent. He would have to make some sort of a blanket confession, like saying something like, "I have strayed, Lord, please forgive me." You know, and he's basically accepting that that he's guilty, which so far he's refused to do. But the motive is all what? What would be the motive for that kind of blanket confession? Yep. Motive is self-interested. It's for the sake of prosperity. And in that, if he does that, then he loses and God loses this wager with Satan. Why would God lose if Job makes that blanket confession and tries to appease God? Because Satan mainly pointed out that he said Job's motive is self-interested. He fears you and does what's right because you bless him. Right? All right, so there you go. That's those are some very important issues in the book of Job, so that's why we review them again. So a couple of things we want to know about Elihu. Does he accept the corollary? Does he accept the corollary? We'll look at that. Second, does he focus on cause or purpose? Okay, do you see the difference? Daniel says purpose, but what's the difference? Who can explain what would be the difference between focusing on the cause of Job's trial and suffering versus on the purpose? Yeah. Right. So it's all about what we all ask when we see suffering. Three-letter word. Now, you can ask this question in two different ways. You can ask it, why did this happen? And you'd be thinking of the cause. In other words, things like, what did I do to deserve this? Or who's to blame for this? Who caused this? Or you can ask this question with the heart to understand why, looking forward. You can either be looking backward at the cause, or you can be looking forward at God's ultimate purpose, right? So we would want to ask, is Elihu focused on the cause of this trial, or is he more focused on the purpose? So we'll try to understand the answer to that question. One more thing, does he tell Job to appease God? Does Elihu tell Job, you need to make a blanket confession so that God blesses you? And we'll try to look and see if that happens. Does he have divine revelation is the last one. In other words, does Elihu know about what is happening, what God's knowledge of this whole issue is? Does Elihu know that Satan went to God and said, let's test, you know, Job only worships you for the sake of prosperity, and that God agreed to it and said, let's test it and see. Does he know that? So we'll go back to these and answer them later on. Now, this is another background issue that I think is pretty neat, and most of the things, I'm kind of tired of this effect here, so I'm going to see if I can take this off. I wasn't supposed to be there anymore.
God is angry.
Yeah, too much of a good thing. It worked well for God is angry, but after that, kind of hideous. So. Okay, here we go. Can you guys see that over here? You might want to move just in case. If you can't see it, then come over this way, because this is now most of what I've shared with you guys in class, I've read from somewhere along the way. But this I actually tried to work this out myself, so this is kind of original at least. And I don't claim to be real original with things, but there probably are some errors here. But I just typed this a few minutes ago, so. All right, now, this is important for understanding how to interpret Elihu, I think. Because we've talked about how a chiasm works, right? How, the ends match up, then these match up, and all the way, and then you have a center of the whole thing. So let's consider this a little bit. I wish I had one of those little laser pointers. Anybody got one? All right. Come on. Doesn't we have an iPhone app or something?
Yeah, there we go.
All right, so now let's test this out and see if this holds true. It starts out with the prologue where Job is blessed and righteous, right? And then it ends with the epilogue where Job is blessed and righteous. True? Okay? Next point down. In the prologue, Job is accused by Satan and destroyed, and that corresponds to in the epilogue where Job is vindicated by the Lord and restored. So it's opposite, but it lines up, right? Satan accuses him and he's destroyed. The Lord vindicates him, which means to say he spoke that which was right. You know, and then he has him intercede for his friends and pray for them. And then the Lord restores him. Next one. In the dialogue, Job laments, and that whole section is about decreation, reversing creation toward darkness and chaos, right? Lines up with here in the dialogue, which we would, in this one I'm including the Lord's speeches in the dialogue because it's still part of that word. Dialogue, the Lord speaks and it's creation. It's all about his creation. Alright? And how he's in control of chaos and things like that. Then D, in the dialogue, there's preventive chastening, which is where it begins, actually, with Eliphaz. So that's that was Eliphaz's first speech. He kind of takes Job's side and talks about how the Lord can warn people in dreams and keep people through this use of chastening. And then we get over here to Elihu, and it's the same thing. His main emphasis is on preventive chastening, and he's kind of on Job's side. Right? So those two line up. But in the center, you see the dialogue has to do with sin and retribution. It's focused on that with the three friends, the rest of that whole section. And then it lines up with Job's final section with that, which has to do with sin and retribution as well. He's just insisting that he's righteous and that he's innocent and doesn't deserve it. So the very center of the book is chapter 28. And what's that? It's a special section, isn't it? It doesn't fit with dialogues or anything else. It's a special one-chapter section. It's a hymn to wisdom. And the whole point is the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the fact that man, on his own, cannot just search out divine wisdom on things. Wisdom belongs to God. Only God knows the way to it. And God has it. So, is it possible, do you think, that this is the central message of the book?
It's wisdom literature, though.
It's wisdom literature, exactly. And the fear of the Lord is the main theme in wisdom literature. That is it is very clearly put right there in the center of the book, I think, for a reason. And I think the structure kind of tells us a little bit what's going on. It helps us understand the book of Job a little bit. Right?
Good job.
So that's, again, you can download the slide, but one of the goals you have if you're studying a book of the Bible is to know the whole structure of it, and so hopefully that helps. You could tell someone the story, make sense of it in a quick way like that. So you think, now if people back then understood the common use of chiastic outlines and the whole poetry in the middle of the book, is a lot of it's arranged like this too, then they might have already been looking for this when they read the book of Job, right? And so they would read the whole thing and try to figure out what the message is, and it would be right there in the middle. So I'm not saying this is not, you know, possibly missing stuff or whatever, but it seems pretty, like it works out pretty well to me. And I don't feel like I'm stretching it a lot there at all. So if you guys have reasons why you think it doesn't work, let me know, because I will discard this and trash it. But it's kind of exciting. So I'm not sure how in-depth to go with Elihu. But let me just kind of go through the full teaching, and I'll probably just pull out little sections to point out for you. All right, so we've already reviewed somewhat. Let's see here. Now, when we study Elihu, we do want to know whether he's right or wrong about Job, whether the things he's saying to Job are correct. But beyond that, we do want to see what he has to say for us, right? I mean, when we read all the Bible, we want to know what we can learn from it personally. So, major complaints against Job, or against Elihu, excuse me, would be what? What are the main things people don't like about him? His attitude would be one, right? He seems arrogant. He talks about how his words are all filling him up, and he's going to burst them like new wineskins. And old wineskins, they kind of lose their stretchiness and tend to burst when wine inside of them expands. But he says it's even a new wineskin is what he compares himself to. So that's how extreme his desire to speak is. He's angry and eager to speak, and Proverbs 10 talks about how that's kind of foolish to be so eager to speak. So that's one point against him, you could say. He says he's not going to answer Job with their speeches in chapter 32, verse 14. But he does repeat material from their speeches, actually. You see him using some of their speeches, and so he kind of contradicts himself there. He might devalue age too much. Remember that? He says that he's waited for age to speak, and basically it's let everybody down. And he talks about how, you know, he's youthful, but he has the Spirit, and it's the Spirit that gives wisdom, not age. But you got to be careful with that line of thinking, right? Because you can devalue age too much. If a person has been through life and they have learned from their experiences, there's a real advantage to that, isn't there? Now, it's not automatic that just because a person is old that they're wise. There is such a thing as an old fool, right? But if a person has been walking with God and seeking wisdom throughout their life, then it is an advantage to have life's experiences and to have your wisdom seasoned in that sense. And so a lot of times an older person is wiser. And so you don't want to discount the value of going to older people for godly counsel if they've been walking with the Lord. And if they've been fearing the Lord, then that's where wisdom can be found. He now, when he repeats some of the previous material, he does make some significant changes, which we mentioned last week. For example, when he sounds similar to Eliphaz. Eliphaz said that Job drinks iniquity like water. Iniquity is sin. Elihu just says he drinks scoffing like water. So his focus is on the way Job's been talking about the Lord throughout this whole ordeal. He also, instead of saying that it doesn't please God when he's righteous, he says basically that it doesn't add anything to God if Job is righteous. So there's some slight adjustments that sort of keep him from going as far as the friends. Yeah. Well, it's obviously common as a human being to drink water, right? You've got to do that all the time. And so the analogy is to, this is how common it is for Job, you know, to take part in that. It's just like drinking water for him. So Eliphaz and the friends were saying it was sin or iniquity. He just says it's scoffing, the way he's talking about God throughout his trial. Okay. Again, the contradictions. He seems to falsely claim divine revelation. And maybe even perfect knowledge. Remember how he says one with perfect knowledge is with you? I think that's in 36:14. But then in chapter 37, he clearly says that it's God who is perfect in knowledge. So we're not 100% sure that he himself claims to be perfect in knowledge. But the whole time, he is claiming to answer on God's behalf. And he seems to claim pretty clearly that he has some sort of divine revelation that nobody else has. He says, listen to me and I'll answer you, right? And he says, I have the knowledge that you need. So that would be a problem. And he may see Job as the one who's on the path to sin, needing preventive chastening, needing to confess sin. And again, it's not 100% clear that he sees Job in this role. But look at chapter 33, verses 27 to 28. 33:27 to 28. And again, the question is whether or not he sees Job as needing to say these words. He's describing a person who goes through suffering and who finds a mediator, and he says, his flesh shall be fresher than a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. He shall pray to God, and he will be favorable unto him. He shall see his face with joy, for he will render unto man his righteousness. He looks upon men, and if any say, I have sinned and perverted that which was right, and it profited me not, he will deliver his soul from going into the pit, and his life shall see the light. So that would be a problem. It's like he's flirting with the idea of appeasement theology there almost. He doesn't come out and say that Job needs to confess his sin. He like the other guys specifically gave Job that advice, right? They said, if I were you, I would do this. And it was appeasement. So he just describes God's workings with men. If you're defending Elihu, you could say he's just describing the way God works with people, painting the picture of how God is just. But on the other hand, if you think Elihu is off track, then you would say he sees Job as needing to confess his sin and get restored, right? So it's iffy, isn't it? All right, on the positive side, Elihu was patient and waited to speak. That was a good thing. He points out the errors of both Job and his friends, as the Lord himself does. The Lord himself said that the friends were guilty and that that Job was also in danger because he was justifying himself rather than God. The Lord asked Job, would you put me in the wrong in order to justify yourself? It's possible you could see Elihu's anger as righteous anger, that he's angry for the right reason, because God's character is being called into question and because Job is being condemned without reason. On the positive side as well, you could say he doesn't appear to accept the corollary. He doesn't assume that just because Job is suffering, that means that he's wicked. He doesn't assume that. He is positive toward the idea of a mediator, right? The other friend said, there's nobody going to answer for you to stand up, you know, before you and plead your case before God. But Elihu is sympathetic to the idea of a mediator helping Job to argue his case before God. He, in fact, says that he desires to justify Job, almost as if saying, if I was the mediator, then I would want to take your part, but you have to listen to me in order for me to do that. He does seem to focus on the purpose rather than the cause. Is there anything you saw in his speeches that saw a cause from Job's behavior that resulted in the suffering. Does Elihu go there? Does he say, this happened, you've brought this upon yourself because of whatever? Did you see that anywhere? I didn't see it either, and I think when he talks about the Lord using suffering as a warning, it's a preventive measure, and that has to do more with purpose, that perhaps Job would have gone down a certain road were it not for this. You know, it wasn't that, that any sin caused it, but that the Lord can use it for a good purpose to keep him from some future sin. That seems to be what he's saying. It is a more sophisticated view, the most sophisticated view, right? He stops short of the errors of the friends. He sees suffering as a warning, and he says in 36:11-12, the passage sounds kind of bad at first, but he actually is talking about how suffering is a warning, and then a person has a choice of how to respond to that warning, and that choice can result in either blessing or consequences, which is true. Look at 36:11-12. If they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures. But if they obey not, they shall perish by the sword, and they shall die without knowledge. The context there is after the warning through affliction, not just any suffering in general. Okay, and then finally, in chapter 37, did you see how it kind of naturally leads up to the Lord's speeches? He's proclaiming God's majesty in creation. He's saying God has superior wisdom and knowledge, and that God has superior power. And those are essentially the same things that the Lord himself does say. So, where do we come out with Elihu? Before we make conclusions, let me just go over, see if there's a few other things I could throw in here. Yes, this one's important. Observe these different translations in English of this section. And again, we said this one, this passage right here would make or break, well, not make or break, but if this could be one of the passages that breaks Elihu. Because, look at how it reads in the ESV, and it's pretty much the same in the NKJV, so you can look at that one too. Men of understanding will say to me, wise men who listen to me, Job speaks without knowledge, his words are without wisdom. Okay, now look how the ESV and NKJV stop that quotation. They only have verse 35 as the quotation from these men of understanding. Does that make sense, CJ? You don't want to miss this. So in these English translations, this is the only quotation from these men of understanding and wise men. Just the verse 35. And then this is written as if it's Elihu's words. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost, because his answers are like those of wicked men, for he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. So if Elihu says that Job is adding rebellion to his sin, he's sinning now with rebellion, present tense, and he had sin before. And if that's Elihu's words, then thumbs down. Because he's saying Job was guilty of sin, whereas God himself said he wasn't. All right, now, were there these quotation marks in the original Hebrew manuscripts that were used to translate, or in the Septuagint even, the Greek translation of the Old Testament? No. So, if you were a translator, how would you figure out where to put them? How would you decide where to put those quotation marks? You've got to take everything Elihu said and figure out, in that context, what would be the best place. But isn't it amazing that, that Elihu's thumbs up or thumbs down can come down to the placement of that quotation mark? Here's the NASB 95 update version. I think the other one has it too, but look at here. This one has the quotation mark starting at verse 35, just like the others, but it doesn't end until after the very end of that speech. And so if that's correct, then Elihu is quoting from these wise men who are saying Job's adding rebellion to his sin. But he himself is not saying that. So it's important, isn't it? Who thinks that it should be like this? Okay? Who thinks it should be like that? What's that?
Is that the one where Elihu is saying?
Well, look at the quotation marks. The single one is the one you're looking at. Where does the single one stop? The close quote? The single quote that closes? Here it's in verse 35, and then Elihu's talking for 36 and 37. This is the NASB, and it closes at the very end.
Okay. You know, should it be both?
Yeah, right. And that's what the question you have to ask is, if it all comes down to this,
then you're trying to figure out something that...
Yeah, it's like, are we going to make a hard judgment on this based on this one quotation mark, which wasn't even in the original? Or maybe should we think about this whole section a little bit differently? And that's where maybe I'm guilty of setting you guys up, because I said, you know, what did I say? I kind of put it to you as yes or no, all in or all out, when in fact I think it's a mixture with Elihu. And you can't say he's all good or all bad. So it was good for the sake of debate and for the sake of learning, because you want to test both hypotheses, right? Remember how we talked about the apologetic method, where you take a hypothesis and then you test it with the data, the actual observable data? We do the same thing with Elihu. What's the first hypothesis? That he's wrong, right? That he's false, man's wisdom, not helpful. So if we believe Elihu's wrong, and just like the other friends, we would have to go through his whole speech and look for anything that confirms that or anything that contradicts that. That's testing that hypothesis. On the other hand, we would take the hypothesis that he is all right on, and you know, he's speaking for God like a prophet. We go through his speech and test that one. Is there anything that contradicts the view that he's correct, divinely inspired, like a prophet? He speaks truth the whole way through. All right, so, and then we test the other one, that it's a mixture. And I think that's the one that fits all the data, because there is a mixture of some good and bad things in Elihu. You can't fully say he's perfect, and you can't fully say he's all bad. So let's think through some of the things we come away with. See here. Here's a verse I'll read you too, because it applies. It says in James 3:17, "But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere." So, is Elihu pure? Is there anything that shows us that he's impure in the way he's going about this, or that there's any problem with him? Is he sinful himself? We just don't know, right? But there's nothing that says he's impure. Is he peaceable? Would you describe him as peaceable? He's definitely angry at the friends, at least, right? And he's angry at Job too, because he's justifying himself rather than God. But perhaps you could say he's trying to make peace between the two, to show them their error and to make peace. All right, is he gentle? He says he's going to be gentle, but not always, right? There again, sometimes he's gentle and sometimes he's not. Is he open to reason? He says that he is, yeah, that he has perfect reason. But there, I think once more, he's open to reason. He says, "Job, answer me if you can." But then he continues blasting everybody for five chapters and closes down everybody else, basically, yeah.
So, given the circumstance, he's angry, and yet there's sort of the demonstration he's controlling himself to a degree,
mm-hmm.
and he has sat and listened to everybody else's speech and sort of considered it. So I think he just sort of finally lost it. He's maintaining a degree of control, probably better than that.
Yeah. But you couldn't say he's perfect, right?
No,
yeah. Did you have something to add, Tom, or was that a scratch? All right, so a couple other things here worth noting. We've got his knowledge of the water cycle. You guys know Sigmund Freud? I had a little side note about the way people face death, unbeliever versus a believer. That's an interesting study. If you want to, you can check that out. There's a DVD in the library called The Question of God, and it compares the lives of C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud. Because they were contemporaries, and they, you know, they had completely different responses to the idea of God. So that's a good video. And so the water cycle, Elihu, some people say that he has divine revelation because of his knowledge of the water cycle. All right, but I think it's pretty sure that his knowledge of the water cycle, the fact that water evaporates, is held, distilled in the clouds, and falls back down, runs down the mountains and back to the sea and all that, that was already understood at the time. So we can't really use that argument to say that he was divinely inspired or had special revelation. Because if God was giving him special scientific knowledge, then surely he would have given him, for this case, you know, if he was speaking as a prophet, he would have given him knowledge of the whole conversation with Satan, probably. So you can't really use the water cycle in that way. And then there's a reference to the sky being hard, how God prevents it from raining, and it's sort of a metaphor for a cast bronze dome, and that keeps the rain from falling down. And this is an example of a bronze mirror, which Elihu compares the sky to when God tells it not to rain. This is actually from about the same time period. All right, so a couple things we can come away with from Elihu. Elihu or Elihu, depending on how you choose to pronounce his name. He's like us in a way, right? That we struggle with explanation. Oh, something else? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it just, everything I looked into, everyone showed a picture of the earth with, you know, the night on one side and the day on the other with this circle where the two meet.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting. So.
Yeah, so in other words, the line that separates light from darkness depending on how the sun is hitting the earth.
So how can you make some darkness happen, right? It is forming a circle.
Yeah.
That's what it means to the point. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And the question is, was that picture from outer space of the earth, was that in his mind or not? But there again, I think it fits. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't cause any problem for sure. So, okay, so Elihu's like us in the sense that he does want to see both upheld, right? He wants to see the justice of God upheld, and he doesn't want to deny the innocence of Job either, or say that Job deserved it like the friends do. So he's wrestling for an explanation as to why. And I think one of the ways we can take Elihu's contribution, and remember, we're asking, why would the Holy Spirit inspire the author to put this in the book of Job? We don't believe, or at least I don't, maybe some of you do, that some later person inserted Elihu into the story. I suppose you could still ask, well, why did, you know, did God inspire that later editor to put it in here, and why was that? That's a possibility, but it just doesn't seem to fit. It doesn't seem to fit because of the outline we went over of the book earlier. So why is he in here? What function does he have? What purpose? How is God revealing himself through this? I think one of the ways to summarize it is you could say that this is the best that limited human wisdom can offer. And some say that Elihu represents Israelite wisdom, which was, you know, in Solomon's time was the best around. You know, Solomon's influence and the wisdom God gave him, you know, spilled out into Israel in general. This was the great era of wisdom literature in Israel. And so some people say that Elihu represents Israelite wisdom, and that's the best that limited human wisdom can offer. So is that one way of possibly making sense of it? Yeah. Yeah, there's certainly a lot. I mean, when Elihu talks about God's use of chastening, it's right in line with Hebrews 12, right? That, I mean, absolutely. So the question is always like, is this true of Job? We know it's true for me, but is it true of Job? And so you were good to point that out for sure. So the best that limited human wisdom can offer, but it's still not God himself speaking. The good thing about him, too, is that he tries to strike that middle course. He doesn't buy into the corollary and just condemn Job, saying he deserved it, he had it coming, he's wicked. And he doesn't let Job's complaints go, because if God is unjust, then we're all lost, basically, right? If God doesn't have perfect character, then, you know, then we're in real trouble. Job may be righteous, but who is God now? So he can't let that slide either, which is a good thing. He still lacks knowledge, though, of the prologue, doesn't he? He still lacks that. He doesn't know that this was a test to see Job's motive for fearing God. And I think also deciding on Elihu, think about this, deciding on Elihu, thumbs up or thumbs down, depends on our decision about Job. Because some people take the book of Job and say that Job didn't sin in his first two responses, but he does sin during the dialogues. And that reveals something in Job's heart that God had to deal with. And therefore, that was what was going on in the book, is God was using this suffering to bring that to the surface, deal with it, so that Job could grow to maturity. Okay, so it still sees a cause in Job, even though that cause, you know, he hadn't actually been in that sin yet. So, do you think Job sinned in his speeches? Did he sin? In other words, did he sin from chapters 3 to 20 or to 31 at some point? Would you say he sinned or perverted righteousness or anything like that? And then, do you think that if he did sin, then this whole thing was because of that sin that was going to come out? You can't answer that yet? Yeah. So was God keeping Job from sin by this trial? Now, we don't want to say there was any, we cannot say there was any cause in Job, right? Because it specifically says that Satan incited the Lord against him without cause. So we'd never say that Job caused this by any lack in his character. However, we could say that there was a good purpose for Job's character that, you know, even though it wasn't the cause of it, that God still did have a good purpose. But we don't want to make that the big point of the book either, do we? Just a scratch? All right. Okay, so if your faith is weak, is that a sin? Well, unbelief is sin.
Yeah,
unbelief is sin, but how extreme does it have to be before it constitutes sin?
Yeah.
And that's an interesting question, because even asking, does Job sin in his speeches? If he said anything that questioned God's character, in a way he's falling short, you could say, right? And the Sermon on the Mount teaches us that it's way easier to sin than people thought at the time. And so basically nobody has an excuse to say that I'm perfect. But what do you think, Steve? Abraham? Right, because now, actually, I remember asking that question in Romans class my first semester here at Bible College 10 and a half years ago. And, well, it was a big deal because we were reading Romans chapter 4 and 5 where it says that Abraham and Sarah never wavered in their faith. And I'm thinking, is Paul reading the same story that I read in Genesis? Because there was several times where they lied to try to keep it going. Sarah laughed. I mean, she laughed when she heard the promise. So, but it's, I think what you come away with is that God knows the full story of a person's life, and he makes that judgment of who he knows you really are. And despite lapses, like, the final outcome is what matters. That Abraham repented of that unbelief, and, you know, that God confronted him, taught him through it. And in the final estimation, Abraham's a believer in faith. Sarah's a believer in faith, and that's counted to them as righteousness. And so, yeah, I think with Job, and it's the same is true. Would God be compassionate on him knowing what he went through? I'm sure, right? I mean, would God, and he doesn't condemn him for the fact that he would justify himself and put God in the wrong. He confronts him about it, but he doesn't condemn him for that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think with unbelief and that kind of stuff, just like with any sin, it comes down to the attitude of the heart. You know?
The heart attitude, yeah.
Having a hard time believing, but you still want to be obedient. I don't think that's sin, you know, if you're just having a hard time.
It's doubting.
So
like the yeah, it's like the guy said to Jesus, I believe that the heaven is my own belief.
Yeah.
But then there is a point where you can like just choose to be rebellious and
yeah.
act on your own belief, and that's when it becomes sin.
Right. Well, and I think you act on, at any point, your decisions, your little decisions right now are directly based on your belief or unbelief. So it's, you know, you're always acting on one or the other. So when we look at Job and this whole question of whether he sinned or came up short in his speeches, I think one thing we can say for sure is that the cause of all this was not a need in Job's character. We don't want to explain his suffering away using this cause. So we can draw a big no through that. Now, the question of purpose, was God able to, just like Romans 8:28 says, in all things, work together for the good of those who love him? Did God have a good purpose for this? Even though it wasn't caused by Job and he didn't bring it on himself for some reason like that? Yeah, there is purpose, but again, we don't want to make that the good purpose God brought out of it for Job. That doesn't mean that's the main reason for the whole thing. The reason for the thing is what? We know this. We're told this. We have the eyewitness place. We're the fly on the wall in the divine courtroom in the beginning, right? So what is the purpose? Or what is the what is the reason? God is worthy of worship, and what kind of worship? Just when he blesses people? No. God is God. God is God, and he's worthy of worship no matter what people get out of it. Right? And the test, the whole reason for the trial was to test whether or not anybody can worship God since God blesses the righteous. Right? Because is it true that God delights in blessing the righteous?
Yeah.
Is it true that God will punish the wicked? And he can't tolerate wickedness, right? And he delights in blessing righteousness. That is what God is like. So, the question Satan asks is, does that whole policy of God, does that make the whole world pointless and questionable? Does that make it impossible for anybody to really worship God truly?
But then, like, those questions, they can, like, it's clear cut if you look at the eternal realm of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much if you go and put it into, like, the temple state. You know?
Exactly. So the principle of retribution is true when it tells us what God is like. It tells us what God is like. He delights in blessing righteousness, and he does punish wickedness. All right? It doesn't tell us that every time we see suffering, somebody's been sinning, and every time we see blessedness, somebody's been earning it through righteousness. So it doesn't describe the world, basically. The principle of retribution does not adequately describe the world. Describe. Elmer Fudd. Okay. So Elihu's speech definitely has literary value. If you see how it fits into that outline, it has literary value, right? You can see how it prepares the way for the end. It represents the best that human wisdom can do in making sense of this. It avoids the errors of the friends. It confronts Job's misguided accusations of God. But what do we still need when Elihu's done? What do we still need? We need God. God's the one who has wisdom, and he's the one we need to hear from, not men. So we all need to hear the voice of God, and that is what we'll get into next week. So you can go over your notes if you'd like to, and I think one thing I didn't mention that is on your test is Elihu's name. Let me back up and go over that for you because that is on your test. Elihu's name. It's the only Hebrew name in the book. That's why one of the reasons why people think that he represents Israelite wisdom. It means he, or Yah, is my God. He is my God. Yahweh is my God is the meaning of it. There are four other people in the Bible that have this name. The genealogy that's given right here for Elihu is the longest of any character in the book. It says he was a Buzite, and that means he was probably related to Abraham. Because Buz was the brother of Uz and was a son of Nahor, who was Abraham's brother. Okay, so picture Abraham living in Ur of the Chaldees. He has a brother named Nahor. And Nahor has he has a son, sons named Uz and Buz. And Buz a descendant of Buzz is Elihu. So he's related to Abraham as a distant nephew, basically. But he's a relative of Abraham. And Buzz was an Arab location, so it's outside of Israel, as we've said before. It says he was of the family of Ram, and that suggests that Elihu was an ancestor of King David, because Ruth seems to have come from the family of Ram as well. I think that's how it works. So, but those are the two things. He was a relative of Abraham, and he was an ancestor of King David. Very interesting, isn't it? How all the Bible fits somehow within that plan of redemption, you know, the lineage that leads up to Christ, and how Christ is the focal point, the ultimate that it all leads up to. Yeah. His name means he is God, or he is my God. Yahweh is my God. Any questions, discussion points, anything we left out? All right. Well, let's take a break. You guys can study a little bit for the test if you want to. We will begin the test at 5:05.
I got my Bible on my phone. Can I use that?
Yeah, if that's all you got.
Oh, well, I got your pamphlet too, and I didn't have it. I don't have any notes in it.
Okay.
All right, cool.
Yeah, but just use like just keep the phone on the Bible on the screen.
Yeah. For your phone. No, can I use the pamphlet?
What? Which one?
The booklet.
Oh, the course guide?
Yeah, I don't.
And there's no
notes.
Well, it has no, because it has some of the answers in it. I think.
All right, then I'm going to go get a Bible.
You can use this one.
All right, cool. All right, you want me to show you how to do that?
Yeah.
This guy has a question for you. This Asian guy over here. All right.
That's okay. Going back to the
Sermon on the Mount is great for teaching you that. It's way easier to sin than you think. And therefore, all of us have to call on God for His grace and mercy. Trust Him to help us.
Okay, so you put that, you just basically shove that on there like a sock.
How'd you do it? Did you get worms out? Like the direction?
All you do is just shove, once you shove it in, you can just pop that out.
And you gotta get the little thing.
Hey, look. No, and you just tie it on right here.
Oh, there it is.
Basically, these are a bit easy. That's like that. I don't know. You kind of swing it like this.
can just take the one foot off your rock and put it on a spinning rail.
It's like 10.
And then and I can put that on there for you. And
yeah, but you don't say it's easy. How do you, what kind of knots
are
so.
Oh, what kind of knot? You know how to do it. You know how to tie it, right?
Oh, no. Well, my sister just got here, so she only has to tie it.
You know how to tie this?
Mine on 11:10.
I was so late, so I need to.
You know how to tie this, right?
Well, I have my way.
You know, like a regular fishing tie? Especially 4 pound test. That's it.
You can catch fish just like this. Just throw that. Seriously. That's how dumb these fish are.
There you go.
Exactly.
Fine. Have a good time. I'm going to go to Bass Pro.
Yeah? I'm going to go and.
Wait.
right, now that I actually have the tests, we can take them. I didn't jog, I rode my bike. I actually jumped on your speed bike and scooted over there real quick. Your sport bike. Sorry. I said speed bike. Yeah, right. Okay, can I have three volunteers? We'll get this going as quick as we can here. You guys know the drill. When you're done, flip it over. You have about 30 minutes to take the test. So that is 10:40. You got to be finished at 10:40. Flip it over in your place, and then we'll grade them in class so that Nancy doesn't get too overwhelmed with extra work when you already have plenty to do. What? All right. I think I have a few extras here which you may run short on. Okay, go for it. It's open Bible, no course guide. That's right, Lance.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And we're going to grade it in class. So you have 30 minutes as of right now. May the Lord be with you. 30 minutes. Okay. Yeah, I don't get out much more than that. I've got a pretty full thing with the family and everything, so. Yeah, but I would like to. I always love to. Especially just kick around and just get warmed up. And
yeah, nothing like
stay fit
for a game. Just go kick around. Just that's right. Stay loose. So.
Exactly. Cool, man. It's a cool card you got there. All right, everybody ready?
Ready when you are, Captain.
Exchange papers with a friend whom you don't trust to cheat for you. As you change papers, I have a couple things to share with you. King James words. There's some good ones here. Did you know in Exodus or in Philippians 1:8, bowels means compassionate feelings. I have such bowels for you, brothers and sisters. How about girls? Girls, do you know what Crispin pins are in the King James?
Those are crackers that are like,
no, it's not crackers. It's curling irons for the hair. Crispin pins. How about evil favoredness? Have you ever called anyone evil favored? It means ugly. He was an evil favored man. Ugliness or deformity? How about, have you ever been holpen by someone? It just means help. Help. Holpen. I've been holpen by you all in some way or another. Have you ever gone to the cafeteria when you're hunger bitten? It just means hungry or famished. Really hungry. I'm hunger bitten. And then when you're hunger bitten, you can go down to the cafeteria and get a mess. A mess just means a plate of food. You might be careful with that because if you say, "What's this mess?" people might take that the wrong way. And you just need to remind them that the King James Version, it just means a plate of food. So people need to be educated, right? All right. Ready to grade? I'm sure you're all hunger bitten, so it's time to get on with this. Okay. So when you mark it wrong, remember the first section is worth 2 points each, so you draw an X minus 2, and that's obviously the opposite of what they mark, so you don't need to do extra marking. And then at the bottom of the page, you can just put minus however many total points, which will make it easier to add everything up later. So, number one, in chapter 27, Job is finally willing to confess his hidden sin. False. Number two, in chapter 27, Job affirms that the wicked are indeed judged by God at some point. True, yes. The last part of that chapter does describe that. Number three, the message of chapter 28 is that wisdom can always be found by diligently studying the world. False. Number four, the point is that it's not. That wisdom is with God, and you can't discover it scientifically by studying the world, so... Chapter 28, if you follow it, it's that this is how, stay with us guys, I missed a great joke there I'm sure, but everybody, we are discussing a question, so nobody should be talking other than if you raise your hand. So chapter 28 is all about how this is how we discover precious stones and gold and silver, but that's not how we find wisdom. Wisdom is with God and we can't discover it, human effort alone. Number four, according to chapter 28, God has revealed that the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to turn from evil is understanding. Has God revealed that? Yes, he has. Number five, in his final soliloquy, Job contrasted his past happiness and honor with his present misery and derision. Very true, that's exactly what he does. In chapter 31, Job denied that he was guilty of any form of wickedness except for rejoicing at his enemy's ruin. False. Number seven, we can see from his background in chapter 32 that Elihu was probably a relative of Abraham and an ancestor of King David. True. In chapter 32, Elihu compared himself to old wineskins that were ready to burst. False. False. It's new wineskins that he compared himself to. And that was, it's important because, you know, if you say old wineskins, well, yeah, they do burst if you put new wine into them. That's why Jesus used the analogy, do you put new wine into old wineskins? No, they'll burst. He says new wineskin will burst, which shows why, how extreme it is, how eager he is to speak. Number nine, it is clear from chapter 34 that Elihu believed Job's trial was punishment for his sin. False. And remember, it has to be completely true, so it's not clear. It all depends on that quotation mark. Number 10 in chapters 32 to 37, Elihu tried to defend God's justice without discarding either the principle of retribution or Job's pre-trial righteousness. True? Exactly true. Multiple choice. These are worth 3 points each. Remember that. Number 1, chapter 27 shows that since he was confident that he would eventually be vindicated, Job was willing to continue doing what he knew was right. C is the best answer. Number two, what was used in the ancient tunneling technique mentioned in chapter 28? Not diamond drill bits. But did you know that diamond cutting, like cutting with diamonds, diamond blades, is actually mentioned in the Bible? Yeah, it is. And it's in the Old Testament, I believe. In Isaiah, I think, is where it is. But not here. This is about fire, cold water, and vinegar is probably the one mentioned. So number three, how is wisdom described in chapter 28? D, all of the above.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
In my Bible, I saw that it said gold and topaz Ethiopia, but I never saw pearls, so I put A and C.
Okay, the best answer, singular, so if it's two, then you got to assume that it's all of them, but I'll give you half credit on that. Does anybody else mark two answers but not all three? And you did it for a good reason, so you can take off 1.5 versus the full 3 points. I should be telling Bree, I guess, since she's grading your paper. All right. Okay, number four. Which of the following is the closest modern equivalent of a city gate in the Old Testament times? A courthouse. Security checkpoint, like the guard shack. Remember, it's the best answer. That's partly true. That is the legitimate way to enter a city, so there's part truth there, but courthouse. Number five, chapters 29 and 30 present a contrast. In months gone by, Job was praised by the most respected members of society, but now he's being mocked by the lowest and most evil favored, right? No, senseless, most senseless. Six, so B, five is B. Six, the type of kiss mentioned in chapter 31 was an ancient gesture of worship. C. Number seven, why was Elihu angry with Job's three counselors? We hammered this point in the time studying it. The correct answer is B. You get that from the first part of chapter 32. Yeah. No, well, even if it was the youngest, then it's still part of the lowest, because it was the most esteemed, you know, the members of the city council, so to speak, most respected, versus kids and good-for-nothings and all kinds of low-ranking people. All right, why was Elihu angry with Job? Ooh. A, thank you, yes. A, he justified himself rather than God. Number eight is A. Seven is B. Seven is B, eight is A. Number nine, according to Elihu, what are the ways that God speaks indirectly? C, dreams, visions, and affliction. That's right, he says God does speak, but people aren't listening. He speaks in dreams, he speaks in visions, and he speaks in affliction. Number 10, what is... by the way, on that, Eliphaz also had a little bit... Like, we talked about how Eliphaz's first speech and Elihu's speeches are kind of parallel on the chiastic outline. Some other similarities are the fact of God speaking through dreams, which was there in Eliphaz's first speech, and the claim of having some kind of divine revelation that other people didn't have. So that lines up as well. Number 10, what is the underlying assumption of any claim that God has mismanaged the world? In other words, if I say God is mismanaging the world, he's not running it properly, what do I assume?
A,
that I as the accuser have a better idea of how the world should be managed. And that's a lot to claim, isn't it? To know more than God, and that's what God's going to confront. All right, so make sure you fill out the very top right-hand corner. Make sure you do so accurately. Then hand the paper back. After you look over your own paper, then hand it in to Nancy. And before we do anything else, your homework is to finish reading Job. Remember, this is you get a score for the second reading through Job. And you're going to be asked about this at the end on the final textbook quiz. And then faith versus evil assignment. A couple of you have done it already, but it's faith versus evil on Job. So everybody understand it? It's still 1 to 2 pages. You look at the whole story of Job and figure out what's the challenge to faith. Really get in depth. Now you understand it at a very deep level. So describe it. Get into his shoes. Why would your faith be challenged? How would you describe those feelings? Everyone listening still, I hope. And then talk about on what basis you can continue trusting God. On what basis did Job continue trusting God? And on what basis can you, therefore, trust God? So let's pray. And then we'll be done. Heavenly Father, we thank you very much for the way that you have stooped to our level, Lord, to give us your word in our own language, to help us understand how to walk with you. Thank you for not leaving us alone in the world, but for giving us your spirit to guide us, to lead us into all truth, to empower us, to serve you. And Lord, we pray that we'd walk in the spirit and bear fruit that counts for your kingdom and is not just something we enjoy for this life, but that counts for all eternity. I pray for each person here as they go to Thanksgiving break, Lord, and get some rest and relaxation, hopefully. I pray that you'd refresh each person to come back and finish strong, to give us all a good time with our family, building each other up in fellowship in your Son. Pray that you'd guard us from temptation that might come in unique ways and ways we don't expect. And Lord, I just pray that you'd bless this time as we set it apart to give thanks to you for your goodness. In Jesus' name, amen. How many of you, this is your last class before break? Anybody? Quite a few, all right. The rest of you have like maybe community service and some stuff like that tonight, so hang in there, you're almost done. I'll probably get to that at some point on the Facebook page, but it's been hard for me to get it done, so I didn't have my laptop this weekend, so we'll see. I had some of you, though. If you want them, I can give them to you. Can you use RAW files or only JPEGs? You can? Because I didn't do JPEGs yet. Yeah. You need like Photoshop or something like that to open them. So, okay, we'll see.
Number three, I only got gold, but maybe it was because I read the new NIV version. So I didn't get
so
anything.
It was pearls.
I didn't get pearls with the best of anything.
Nuggets of gold. Golden gold here, precious onyx or sapphire, gold or crystal, jewels of gold, precious topaz of Kush, that's the same as Ethiopia. Yeah. And cannot be gold. Yeah. So, and there wasn't another option that was as good, so. And it definitely had. Topaz was there. So, I mean, I can see how maybe you think that would rule it out. I'll give you half. 1.5.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was, this whole thing you're talking about, the quotations of how if it stops here, you know, that's what just.
Yeah.
What his friends are saying, this is what he is saying, but if it stops over here, that's what he, you know.
Mm-hmm. He's quoting from everybody else.
But I was thinking, if it says, men of understanding say to me and wise men who listen to me say the whole thing, wouldn't he in a way be implying that he agrees with those people?
Not necessarily. I think he's telling about the situation and saying, do you think this is right?
Okay.
You know, because that's how he follows it up. Do you say... You know, he's saying, this is what everybody's saying. Is that what, you think that's correct? Is that what you're saying? You know, he's asking him to answer back and refute what they're saying about him, you know. That's how I think it works. But not 100%.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I want to ask, actually, a completely different question off of the class.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know which king was cursed on... last king that was cursed that wasn't going to have a seat on the throne?
There was a few that was said to. Now, it was funny thing is, it was actually said to Manasseh. And this is important because it was actually said to Manasseh, but like with a lot of the judgments, there's always a built-in condition. If they repent, then it's not necessarily the same. Like the same way God told Nineveh with Jonah, you're going to be destroyed in so many days. But if they repented and God relented. Same with Manasseh. He repented and God relented the judgment. So what all everything he said about how they wouldn't have a son and all that stuff didn't have to be carried out because he actually repented. So there one was Jeroboam. He said, that was the first king of the northern kingdom. He said, you know, your legacy is going to be taken away and destroyed, basically. I think the last one was Jehoshaphat. But then there's a difficulty. Are you thinking about the difficulty and how that leads to the lineage of Christ?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the best.
Was it Jehoiakim?
It was Jehoiakim.
Jehoiakim,
yeah. He, that was what was said, you know, your sons won't. And I forget, I have a way that it works out. I think it's in my Luke stuff for Luke class. I can try to find it and email it to you. you want. Because I compiled some stuff about that whole issue, mm-hmm. and had, like, I think just a few bits of material on possible solutions to that problem. But, yeah, I can try to send that your way. I just don't know it off the top of my head. There's some complicated things that happened in that time period where it technically was fulfilled, but in weird ways. Yeah. It does work out, I can tell you that, but
yeah.
it's some of it's uncertain, too, as far as knowing exactly how, but there's some different theories on how possibilities.
Yeah, I think I've heard it, like, before. I think, actually, Joe Holden talked about
okay,
it in class
went over
before.
It?
And then, but then I'm trying to, like, well, because I'm trying to write a book.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And I'm talking about some different things, and I'm looking at how God has blessed David,
mm-hmm.
and even though that one of his sons was like cursed, that still
mm-hmm.
the seed of David still brought
yeah.
him to Jesus, and even though all the things that he's done and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
still God used David to, and this is the man
yeah.
that was after, that God said
mm-hmm.
is after his own heart and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
You know who's good on that is Walter Kaiser. He points out how there's this promise to David, and it's certain from his seed is going to come the Messiah, and it's going to be an everlasting kingdom and all that. But along the way, you have people who sacrifice their own share in that. But they, at the same time, they sacrifice and inherit, you know, consequences. But they can't help except transmit that promise down. And eventually, God gets this man, you know, and it's fulfilled. You know what I mean? So the individual may be unfaithful and sacrifice things and do things that have consequences for their family and all this stuff, but they transmit it. They don't participate and enjoy the blessings, but they can't help but pass it on down if they're not faithful. So if you can send me an email on that, then that will help me remember to reply to it with your
okay.
stuff. So it's just joelwingo@calvarychapel.com. It's on your syllabus.
Hey, hold on. Yeah, hold up.
You can do it. Like, you can click on my name on Populi from the course if you want, but it's right here.
Is it? Oh, it's on that. Okay.
JoelWingo@calvarychapel.com.
Okay, so I'll just send you an email. And then
mm-hmm. Yeah, just tell me what you're looking for again. Remind me, and then I'll send it everything I can your way.
All right.
Try to keep it organized easily so you don't have to read a bunch of extra stuff.
All right.
Cool,
thanks.
Man. All right. Look forward to following up with you. Oh, the DVD? Oh, the book? Yeah, there's a book. Is it? There might be two different ones. Yeah, Nikolai, the Harvard professor that has the roundtable discussion. It's really interesting.
Okay, and so I watched a little bit of that video on YouTube. Is he the one leading the discussion on that day?
Nikolai leads the discussion. Yeah. And then he has a panel. Like, it's like he does like a class, a roundtable class with people from different walks of life. Like Michael Shermer's on there.
Yeah, I noticed that.
The skeptic, the guy who's always arguing against Christianity.
Now, Armand's a Christian.
I think he is a Christian. He's probably more like what would be a liberal Christian or whatever, I think. But and unfortunately, the Christian just caves in on the thing. Have you seen the whole video?
No, I just started watching it yesterday. I wasn't able to finish.
Okay, yeah.
Who was the
Christian? I think it was an older businessman guy. I think he was the closest thing to coming from our, like, you know,
right.
a biblical evangelical Christian.
Yeah, he wasn't equipped, right?
He wasn't equipped and just blows it. So it was sad the way it all worked out. He just can't answer it. When it comes down to it, misses the chance. Doesn't share the gospel, caves in, has no answer. So it's sad, but it's really good to see the contrast between Lewis and Freud.
Well, have you read the book?
No, I've got the transcript of the whole thing, but I didn't read the book. Is the book the transcript, or is it kind of a whole...
The book is different.
It's different, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The book is... I guess he wrote the book, and then Howard asked him to do the course.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Sweet.
I heard about it from Howard Hendricks.
Oh, really?
One of his tapes.
Cool.
He was talking about it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, man. I think I watched it twice, actually. Because I like stuff like that.
So even with the Christian caving in, was there anything for us?
I think there's stuff from Lewis. What they do is they dramatize the video piece of their
they have
two characters. They dramatize and read out of the writings of both
of
them. And so I think Lewis's material.
Yeah.
But what I had printed out was kind of like Freud at death, the description from the Freud scholar about how he was when he died, shaking his fist at God, refusing, you know, to believe in God to the very end.
cranes, he's a daughter and grandchild and all that stuff, tongue cancer. But Lewis, the difference between Lewis facing suffering is pretty interesting.
So that's the point of it, is to show the contrast between the mental state of a believer.
The thing to do some of these issues on the question of God, especially his role and key on suffering there, and to see how a believer and unbeliever respond to it. And like Nikolai doesn't force it to like be passing judgment. It's more like understanding both sides and being educated through it. Like,
is he favoring one side?
No, he's just real fair to both of them.
Okay. I'm just wondering if it's a good resource for an unbeliever.
I don't think it's like, I wouldn't describe it as, it's a conversation starter, but I wouldn't say it's like going to help give an adequate presentation of the gospel at all. I think it's educational for sure and beneficial to think through the issues. But I think after that, you could really discuss it and bring it to a point where you need to, like, you know, look at the gospel clearly in light of all that and see what difference it makes.
Not enough.
Yeah, but in the movie itself, the gospel is not really.
I'm wondering about the books.
Maybe there's more in the books that I don't know maybe enough about Nikolai.
I heard he came out of an evangelical church.
Did he?
Yeah.
Man, a lot of those guys do. They get
fireball.
They
get sick of religious
hypocrisy. Well, you know, and some of the times atheists really do us a favor by pointing out problems that he does.
Yeah. It's a terrible way to look at it, but it's true.